Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
And I'm Babe.
Oh, God.
And I'm Lyle.
You just had to do that, didn't you?
Oh, hey, why does Bane get to go before me? So he's only like an infrequent guest host.
Right. Jeez. You know what? I really hope we get people writing in saying, enough with the goddamn Bane already.
If only they could find a way to write in that voice.
Well, we could just read it in that voice.
That's what we'll do. Any listener email will read it in the Bane voice.
Oh, jeez.
I wish you guys would stop doing Bane voices.
Like, right now. I know you're reading it in the voice. Please stop that.
Not even in your head. Just stop it. Stop it.
So, some big news again from Dungeons & Dragons. And if there's one thing that they do well, is it certainly update you on what they're going to do.
So, big news is Living Rule Set. Which
were you waiting for something?
I'm actually waiting for Wayne to just explode.
Right. Nope, I'm still getting over the stupid Bane voices. So, basically, Mike Merle said that the Dungeons & Dragons game is going to be called a, quote, living rule set, which means that they are going to continually update it.
Well, the basic gist about it is that they say they intend to incorporate a lot of the feedback from the community, both through forums and emails and things like that, but also through what they plan to be a yearly review, kind of like the follow-up surveys they did after each playtest. And then they plan to take those that feedback and put it into the game and change numbers and rules and things where needed. They say they want to use a very light touch where it's something that they can only put out FAQs, maybe like changing a number here or there. But one of the goals with this updating the rules, this live rules idea, is that they don't want to invalidate the books. They say if we make it change things to the point where you have to buy new books, then we failed in our job at that.
Right. That's a good point. I found the section where he says that, yeah, you mentioned, Chris, the annual surveys. And he said, these surveys will not only allow us to identify trouble spots in the game, but we can use them to look at how attitudes change over time. By comparing one year's results to the next, we can get a sense of how the game is changing. And he said that if they do find a problem, what they do and how they handle it will depend on how big a problem it appears to be. If a rule is unclear or if things need to be clarified, then as you said, Chris, they can put it in an FAQ or a similar resource. But they said if it seems to be a really big problem, if absolutely necessary, then they will update the rule set.
And it sounds like they're waiting for some kind of unanimous opinion about something. For example, they said if a lot of players don't like a rule, but a lot of DMs do like the rule, then they'll probably keep the rule. Or if, you know, one group of people like it, a group of people don't like it, they probably won't change it.
I think he said that players would either have to say it's a problem because it's too weak or it's too overpowered, and the DM would have to say this is causing a headache. So right. I think enough players and enough DMs would have to say something is wrong with this for them to change it, which, okay, fair enough. My whole takeaway from this is I don't really see how this is different from Errata. And although he said that if players feel they need to change their books, they've gone too far, I think that's pretty subjective. Because when do you feel like you have to change the book? That's kind of a personal choice. Like it. One number being wrong, well, I guess that's a bit extreme, but, you know, pretty small changes may cause someone to feel that the book is useless, whereas other people might, you know, need really massive changes to go out and change a book. So I think there's a lot of subjectivity there.
I think if we're looking at a difference between a first printing and a third printing, people are used to that. They're used to, I mean, the first printing having a lot of mistakes, and then you expect the errata, and then the second printing and the third printing and subsequent printings are much cleaner versions of those books. Mm-hmm. very few people would feel the need to abandon an early printing to upgrade to the next one. So I don't see the problem there. So that's the minor stuff. But
you know, though, I'm sorry to jump in on that, but I think this might be a little bit of tenderness left over from 4E, because you guys remember they released that 4E Essentials set a while back, and that was after there had been so many changes and so much power creep and expansion to the original 4E books that a lot of people were complaining that the 4E books just didn't work anymore with the system because it was a bit out of control. So they released the Essentials, which was kind of a pared-down, simplified version of the rules, and that had... it was mixed, but I'd say maybe 60% of the people did not like how it turned out. So
I think at that point it was just too little too late.
I agree. I think that maybe they might be a little bit tender from that, you know, to say if they went to something like doing another Essentials print of 5E, then they haven't done a good job with making the game.
No, obviously what happened in 4E, which... or is a huge influence on what they're doing right now. And I guess it just made them, I hesitate to use the word, but afraid to commit and afraid to release an edition and say, this is it. You know, thanks for all the feedback and the playtesting over 2 years. We've incorporated that, and we've really released a product that we're really proud of and can stand behind.
Right.
And they seem to be really gun-shy about doing that.
No, I completely agree. And I don't know, part of what is... I don't know, irritating me here is that I feel like the D&D 5e rule set will perpetually be in beta testing. It's kind of like, as you said, Lyle, they are not, they don't feel confident with them saying they're going to keep releasing these annual surveys, asking what you like, what you don't like. It seems like, they're not confident and they haven't committed to nailing down a product, and they're just going to continue to say, tell us what you want, we'll keep making changes, we're sorry for fourth edition.
Well, that's kind of how the industry goes now. I mean, most Google products stay in beta for years and years and years because, you know, that absolves them of when people say that there's problems and bugs. They say, well, it's not that
exactly,
yet.
Which may have been a very smart move on their part, because if some people do complain, they can always say, oh, sorry, well, it's still this living rule set. We'll make changes.
We'll consider it in the next rule
set. Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know, part of me just wants to say, well, then, you know what, give it another, and I know they can't because they don't have anything out, but give it another year or two and then really nail down what you are 100% confident that people will like, rather than kind of doing this perpetual beta testing.
Like, do people want that? I know Fantasy Flight Games will release a beta and people pay for it and provide that, but then they release the actual rules. And you feel like, okay, here are the rules to the Star Wars game.
Right.
It's not a beta and they've released it. But do people want a constantly evolving rule set? Now, they might want a constantly evolving campaign setting.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
But do they want the rules to constantly change? And that doesn't mean that there can't be additions that can come up. Let's say if you release a Dark Sun campaign setting and they have some unique rules attached to that, that's fine. But do people want a core set to change over a couple of years?
That's a really good question.
People don't seem to be terribly happy when Games Workshop quote unquote improves the game and comes out with another edition very quickly.
Right.
So I can't imagine that people are going to be that thrilled with D&D.
Well, I don't know. I think it might be underestimating the annual surveys, letting people, quote, have a voice in where the game goes. And I think enough people might say, yeah, it's great, I'm shaping my favorite game, so keep changing it, which honestly does not appeal to me at all, because I do not want a game designed by committee. I want a game designed by game designers who know what they're doing.
And also, what would be a significant survey size or response rate? Because if they're talking about percentages, and it's like, well, if most people like it, or if there's a pretty even split, we're not going to change it or something. But how many people have to respond for them to make these decisions?
Yeah.
Right.
But that said, you know, it's not like a Games Workshop kind of game. You know, there isn't a big competitive scene or tournament. You don't have to buy the new shiny stuff. So if you don't like the changes that they've made, then you don't have to use them. If you like the original edition that's released, then just play that.
Yeah, but you know what? I bet whatever changes do make it into the rules update are going to be used at official D&D events, which means if you want to play in Friday Night Delves or Wednesday Night Encounters, whatever, you're going to have to use those rules.
Yeah, I suppose that's the case, but I don't. Yeah, how popular is that?
I have no idea. Mm. Yeah, but I kind of see this as a way for Dungeons and Dragons to take a little bit of what magic is doing, where every magic block introduces new mechanics and kind of a new theme, but they don't change the underlying structure of the game. Like, you can always look at a block of new magic cards and you're going to know how to play because the core is always the same. I guess they're going to do that with D&D. I have no idea. I would hope that they would do that with D&D. As Lyle mentioned before, why not just do that with settings? Why not say, here's the Forgotten Realms setting, and when we do Dark Sun, when we do Eberron, when we do whatever other settings we're coming out with, then we'll introduce rule tweaks, and it'll kind of be bound to that setting rather than the game as a whole.
Yeah, I don't know. I was actually talking to Lyle about that after you finished work. I think it's a lot easier to do with a card game, like Magic, because as they release the new cards, there's a certain amount of power creep. As the new cards, they get plus one bonuses here and there. And that's okay with Magic cards, because as the old cards get weaker, less useful, then you can just stop using them. And by now, you probably have enough of the newer cards bought up that you're okay. But with an RPG book, you keep those core rules and you use them throughout the whole life of the game. And once those original rules are too weak, then what do you do? You know, do you release that new set of $50 books and ask all your customers to jump in on them?
Well, that's not what we're suggesting. It's like they've already got the idea of a block.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to, like, the Tyranny of Dragons block that's going to come in. Mm-hmm. So they already have that idea, which we think we kind of guessed that they've borrowed from Magic. And it's something that they can use to refresh the game every year, every 2 years, mm-hmm. so they have more product to sell.
Mm-hmm.
So we're saying, if you're going to do that anyway and refresh it, then why not use that opportunity to introduce rules? Because people are going to have to buy books for these narrative blocks. But you're absolutely right about the idea of the rules. For one thing, in Magic, you only have one product, and it's the card.
Mm-hmm.
The rule books themselves are like throwaways.
Right.
You can just print them off the website, mm-hmm. because it doesn't matter. Like, right. That's not where they make their money. They make their money on the cards and what they represent and the rules that they say on those. So they can change the rules or tweak the rules, and it doesn't matter because people want the cards, and they always mm-hmm. have to buy the new cards, whereas people don't want to buy new rule books constantly.
Yeah.
So they certainly can't replicate it. And I guess that was what we were thinking, and the concern is they were trying to replicate it.
Yeah.
And maybe too faithfully, mm-hmm. whereas they could try to borrow some elements of Magic and incorporate it into what they're already doing, and then maybe that might be more successful. And yeah, like Wayne's right. I mean, there's certainly something to envy about Magic,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know,
it makes money.
it makes a lot of money, and it's been very, very consistent. Like the Magic that I first started playing in the '90s. Is very similar to the Magic I would play now.
Right.
And even mm-hmm. when they add the rules, it's still Magic.
Yeah.
I mean, they haven't even changed the card backs.
Right. That was originally what Richard Garfield was going to do. Different card backs or different blocks, and thank goodness he didn't.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, they look at that and how the people can just stay on board into this one game with one core rule set, in a sense. And, you know, they don't, even when they release a block like Kamigawa or whatever, it's very... had a very Japanese flavor. People don't go, that's not Magic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They go, that's Magic, but, you know, I didn't really care for this block. This was a weak block, but everything's always Magic.
But right. I still knew how to play.
Well, I don't think that any of the expansions that they put into D&D games really would make you forget how to play, because the basic D20 system is still the same. Still this basically same skill list, maybe one or two differences.
Yeah, but...
Compared to the title, the Living Rules, that's kind of what gets me. Because there's a lot of living card games and things like that have been released recently. And I'm wondering if that's kind of a playoff of that.
I don't. That was certainly not a mistake, what they called it there. Yeah.
But, you know, that's kind of the model that that RPGs have been doing for, 30 years now? Because the living card games, they release the core set, and then they release expansions upon that. But that's kind of basically what... D&D does. They have their core book set, and then they have expansions on that. Essential Fighters, this campaign setting, these adventures.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they actually had the rule, the name Living, with Living Greyhawk and that.
Mm, yeah.
So it predates actually the living card games, so I could see why they do it. But the idea is like, I don't know where Fantasy Flight Games or what they're thinking with the living card game. Mm-hmm. But with the Living Greyhawk, it's people in the community contribute to what happens in Greyhawk.
Right.
So the living idea for Dungeons & Dragons means people contribute to how the rules or how the game evolves.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's my idea. But yes, certainly, yeah, I think the living card game follows a pretty standard RPG business model, except it's mm-hmm. cards, so it yeah. can...
And it seems to be working better.
Well, yeah, because it's cards, because people need cards to play, and it is competitive. Right. And I think that's a really good point you raised, Chris, is that when something's competitive, it follows a slightly different business model.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of the problem with Games Workshop is that they're trying to, you know, they're letting the purchasing habits of the players dictate what the rules are. So if people are not buying enough vehicles, then they'll change the rules so the vehicles are more powerful.
Yeah.
Not because it makes for a better game.
So. Yeah, they purposefully unbalance the game in favor of whatever will sell better. And I hate them for it.
Yeah. All right, well, now to the main topic, which is nothing to do with D&D.
At all.
Because that's the establishment.
Right.
And that's not what we're going to talk about today.
Smooth.
So what we're going to do is look at an existing subculture, like one that actually we have in the real world, and look at how it can be used in games, and in some cases, how it is used in games. Case in point with punk, which is what we're going to talk about today. And this came about because, Wayne, you were having a conversation, I'm going to guess, on Twitter.
Correct.
That's where you have your conversations.
Right. It's either that or in the lunchroom at work.
Yeah, and it wasn't me. So you were talking about steampunk and cyberpunk.
Right. Somebody on Twitter mentioned that they were kind of tired of seeing all the whatever punk trend in RPGs and how it seems like anything and everything just slaps punk onto the end of, you know, kind of some other word to make it kind of hip and edgy.
Because there's cyberpunk, steampunk.
Steampunk.
Right.
And
diesel punk, primal punk, jade punk is the name of a fate thing. Basically, yeah, you can stick punk on the end of anything.
What is jade punk? Like China punk?
Yeah, it's kind of like a mashup, you know, kind of the wire fu martial arts stuff, the wandering swordsman mm-hmm. and Western stuff. And
okay.
Of course, there's technology there, but
yeah,
and yeah, I've kind of felt the same way, and so yeah, kind of got me thinking about what actually punk means.
So, what does it mean? Turns out that's harder than we thought.
Yeah,
and we talked about it, and we thought like, and there's maybe some debate, but for something like steampunk, where maybe they slapped the wrong word after steam. Because maybe it's not necessarily punk, or the way most people play it doesn't have a lot of punk sensibilities, in our opinion.
They used to put corset on the end of it, steam corset.
Yeah, they seem to have, okay, well, cyberpunk is a game that has cybernetics, and it's kind of built around that. So we want to build this around steam technology, and of course, books like The Difference Engine, written by, Sterling, and that he also wrote some cyberpunk novels, so it's like that connection. But it's really just kind of Jules Verne that people are playing.
Right.
Well, Gibson. I mean, he's kind of the father of cyberpunk.
So the big question is, what is punk? And that is actually a big question, so we're going to break it up into a bunch of smaller questions. And like the Bechdel test, we've put together a series of questions that you can ask yourself. And if you answer yes to all or most of these questions, then yes, indeed, your game is punk.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it says cyberpunk, urban fantasy, or steampunk, if you can answer yes to these, then you've got a punk game. And if you're getting a lot of no's and it doesn't matter if it is a cyberpunk game, then you're not really playing a punk game.
You can still play it.
Punk it up.
Yep, you can still play it and have fun, just don't call it punk.
No. We're going to play cyber. Cyber something.
Cyber conformity.
What are you guys playing today? Steam.
Steam. Because those pretentious asses. That's idle at hands.
Yeah, exactly. If you call yourself punk, we're going to come over and ask to join the game.
Okay. So the first question is,
are the punks against the establishment and for individual freedom?
Right, that was the big one for me. And even before we started doing research, just from enjoying cyberpunk literature and kind of looking at cyberpunk games, the punk part said that you or the people who are going to be the characters of this game are on the fringes of society and kind of not maybe outcasts, maybe criminals, or they've chosen to live, you know, off of the grid or outside of the system, and they're working against kind of social norms. They're working against what is normality, for a sense, and they are, they've chosen to leave whatever system or whatever society is prominent in your setting because they value their individual freedom and they don't just want to be another faceless cog in the machine. And we see that a lot in cyberpunk, where the setting seems to be, okay, you know, corporations have taken over. Everybody who works in a corporation, except for the really high ups, are just faceless drones and can be replaced at a moment's notice. And they kind of go home to their, you know, box, wherever, and everything is kind of bland and samey. And the cyberpunks in those settings say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to sort of fight against that and live outside of that society.
I think a lot of cyberpunk authors and filmmakers and whatever, they make it really easy for themselves for the characters to be against the establishment because they paint the establishment as so dystopian and evil. Corporations have taken over the planet, the environment is screwed, the government is corrupt. So even a regular person could be counted as kind of on the fringe because they don't go along with all of those things. So I think they make it easy for themselves, but a very important part of being a punk is being against the power. Fight the power.
Yeah, and this brings us to a second question, which does combine with this, is that has society failed groups of people?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's no surprise that punk would come out of a time where people felt very disenfranchised. I mean, pre-punk or proto-punk is from the late 60s when the Vietnam War is going on and the youth don't feel connected. Then you got the 70s with a lot of unemployment.
Mm.
Especially in England, so then a lot of punk is coming out of there. Detroit was down. There's the proto-punk, the Stooges and Death bands. They come up, and the kids don't feel connected to mainstream society, so they're against it, and they feel that they just want to do what they want. And yeah, when you're creating a setting, and like Chris said, like the cyberpunk writers and people who create the games, they say, well, we need a society that's failing or failed.
Right.
And one way to do it is like to build up the big mega corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're really bad. And then a game like, for example, Shadowrun, which has elements of cyberpunk, they borrow heavily for that the mega corporations are bad, governments are weak.
Mm-hmm.
People want to break away and become independent. So it's like a real punk mentality in a sense there.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean... even if the society was working, it's just not working for some people.
Right.
Because a dystopia implies that it's not working for anyone, really.
Yeah.
But you could have one that's working just fine for a lot of people, but for some it's not.
Well, we brought this up in a previous episode, maybe the Transhuman episode, where, you know, Logan's Run, like that society works, except for a certain group of people. Once you hit 30 or however old it was, then... society, I guess, kind of works, not you're still following the rules, but it's actively working against you. And so I could see that being set up, that's a perfect punk setting where, okay, now we're going to rebel against the system because for us, for this group of people, for whatever reason, the society no longer works.
Yeah, and you could stretch it a long ways across the board. You could do something like the Hunger Games, where there's actually only a very small, select group of people who have it really good, and the rest of society is in kind of underneath them. Or you could do it the other way, where most of the society is utopia, but there's a small group of very disenfranchised people. I think we talked about it in the cybernetics episode a few years back.
Right.
Where there was people who had been turned into robots and had to work as slaves, even though there weren't that many of them, but still, for them.
I could see it working in a few ways there, like using the Logan's Run example. Now, when you have somebody who's over 30 and they're kind of rebelling, they're really just running away from being killed.
Right.
So it's hard to build a subculture when you're on the lam. You're a fugitive. So what you could be is like somebody who's in their late teens or early 20s who thinks, well, what's the point? This is, you know, society, it doesn't work. You know, I'm not going to conform. I'm not going to pretend during my 20s that this is a functioning society. It's not. I want to be free. There's something wrong. Just break away from this. And they form their own subculture that's against the establishment. But they're not necessarily actively doing anything about it, but they're rebelling in their own way through their interests, their music, their fashion, or something like that.
Their crushing sense of nihilism, because what's the point? In 10 years, I'm going to be killed. So
So let's just do whatever I want. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And if you want to do that kind of a gray zone thing, there's so much to work with from the real world. I mean, look at the situation in Russia with Pussy Riot.
Yep.
Yeah, against the whole Putin regime. Actually, you know, if you want, you could look at the States as well with the whole 99% protests.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say the Russia one, at least from our Western perspective, was pretty easy because that seems pretty evil.
Mm, yeah.
So I think it's worth pointing out that, like, punk runs the entire spectrum of political ideals. Like, it kind of, like, they do value individual freedom. And in a lot of media, it kind of, as you said, Chris, it's kind of easy to be against the evil, corrupt governments or whatever power structure is in place. But, like, that doesn't mean they're conservative or liberal or that they have to be, because it runs all spectrums.
Yeah, very good point. I think some of the original punk groups were very agnostic or even atheistic, but there's also all these different religious versions of it. I think, what was it, Taqwakor is the Islamic punk one, and Krishnakor for Hindu punks. I didn't find any special word for the Christian ones, but they are also out there.
Aren't they oppressed in, like, Indonesia because they're against Islam?
The ones that I read about were in the States, and they were against a lot of the stricter teachings of Islam, but I don't know anything about the Indonesian ones.
Oh, okay. Well, like, punk in general is suppressed there.
I would imagine it's kind of looked down on in fanatical Islamic places.
Yeah.
Right. And this these two questions get into maybe one of the issues I have with the term steampunk. Generalization, of course, people tend to play the Lord.
Yeah.
You know, or they play, like, Captain Whatever from the Persian Lancers. And I was reading something, like an article about is steampunk punk, written by somebody, of course, is a steampunk fan, and they were saying, well, you know, you can have a strong female character in Victorian times, and I'm like, but, you know, something in that game, it's not as if this person's going against the establishment, it's just that we're applying a modern sensibilities, and people want role-playing games to be inclusive, so they're very reluctant to put Victorian sensibilities into the game. So if somebody wants to play Captain of the Persian Lancers and, it's a female, you're going to go, I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it's not like that person's created this subculture of female punks that are going against a very strict Victorian ideals. Mm-hmm. They're just playing a pretty cool character.
No, and I think I completely agree with you. Like, punk being what it is, ideally it's kind of gender neutral, and I sort of see the same thing you do, Lyle, where people just kind of play whatever because they don't want to deal with the archaic sensibilities of whatever setting they're playing in, and so the setting seems to be fairly inclusive, where you could totally do that in a punk game, but only the punk group would be all inclusive and not see gender or ethnicity or social class or whatever. My feeling is, and again, I'm agreeing with you, for the game to be punk, the society has to have these rules that you are rebelling against. And especially in steampunk, if you're setting it in kind of this Victorian setting, then you're going to have to mirror those Victorian moralities and Victorian rules. And in that one, certain classes and genders, well, they're only being like two, were oppressed. And you know what?
Okay, someone's very 2010.
All right.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying, though?
Yes. Well, and I think this leads into our next question is their appearance and behavior designed to shock or provoke? And using the Victorian example, and Wayne and I were talking about this, about if you're doing like a character who's gay, Now, having a character who's gay and, hey, nobody has a problem with that, again, that's modern sensibilities applied to the Victorian era. If you're doing, hey, it's gay and I gotta hide it, you're kind of playing...
within the society.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. just what gay people did back in that time, and they weren't really punks, they were just oppressed. So the idea is they would flaunt their sexuality because they knew it would shock people, or even somebody who was bisexual or actually heterosexual would act gay, I guess you could say, or have a male partner just to shock people. Mm-hmm. In a sense, the Red Viper in the Game of Thrones is, I mean, he's a bisexual character, but I think like he would do it in a sense to shock and provoke people. So in a sense, you could say that he's punk.
Right.
He's medieval a punk character.
There you go.
And I think that's a pretty good illustrative example of what we said before. That's why Pussy Riot is considered to be punk in Russia, because they are outlandish in their shows and activities. They're doing lots of illegal stuff as well, but it doesn't apply to the 99%ers in New York who really they protested and they hung out in the park, and you know, more power to them for it, but they didn't dress outlandishly or behave extremely rude, though there were a couple of bad people, bad actors there. And that's why you would call one punk and not the other.
Right, exactly. And again, much like there has to be a system in place that you're rebelling against, I think this is what really makes a punk game punk, is that you are intentionally doing this. You are intentionally acting the way your character acts, or your character's intentionally dressing the way they dress, just to provoke shock and elicit some kind of reaction from all the people who are conforming and who are part of that society. And mm-hmm. I don't know, if you just kind of, we were discussing again about this at work, where Shadowrun, which is arguably cyberpunk, but those people kind of, if you're on a mission, like, seems like you kind of tend to sneak around and you want to blend in and not get caught, where that doesn't seem like punk to me.
I agree.
You have that mohawk and you have that old Osakan lady leopard print full-length coat because you want people to notice you.
I'm wondering how many of our listeners are going to get that old Osaka lady.
Maybe none, but...
I think think Jersey Shore, maybe.
All right, there you go. There's a new subgenre of punk for you, granny punk. They're intentionally dyeing their hair blue and yellow and wearing those leopard print coats.
And they do. They know that people think it's outlandish and tacky, but they still do it.
Hmm.
Because, hey, that's us. That's who we are. No one's going to tell us otherwise.
Right. No. And speaking of gender, well, again, doing research, it's exactly kind of what you said, Lyle. Like, heterosexual guys would intentionally wear bra and panties either over their clothes or nothing, just that, and they weren't gay or they didn't, you know, they weren't transvestites or they didn't want to be a woman or anything like that. They just wore that specifically because it was so against the norm of what society, you know, embraced, that, hey, I'm intentionally doing this to shock you.
And then we were talking about whether or not steampunk fashions applies to, if those could be deemed punk in that they are designed to shock or provoke, but I don't think that's really what they're intended to do. It seems to be more functional and Jules Verne sexy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the opposite. It's actually designed to appeal to people.
Mm, yeah. It's supposed to look cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to look cool and nice, and especially like the steampunk, you know, pinup girls are supposed to be sexy, where if they actually were punk, they would be completely rejecting the ideals of feminine beauty.
And before today, I did not know that there were steampunk pinup girls.
Okay. How did you not know that?
I don't know.
Have you not used the internet?
Never thought to combine steampunk and pinup girl.
Jeez.
It's just one of those things. You type steampunk into a Google image search and that's
all you get is girls in corsets, really, with a couple gears slapped on.
But, you know, actually, that's something to talk about as well, is that, you know, one of the big ideals of punk is that you are dressing and acting outrageously to go against the trend. So it doesn't actually matter what you are wearing or doing as long as it bucks the trend. For example, if you look at some of the pictures in Shadowrun, you'll see that everybody wears some pretty crazy clothing. They've got these light up hairdos and wild makeup and things like that. You know, somebody in that setting to be punk might dress grunge or just not dress up at all.
Or just t-shirt and jeans.
Yeah, some way to push against that. So
I'm going
to,
yeah, but I think a lot of punks cluster together, so they'll all dress outlandishly, and I mean there are hairstyles that, like the Mohawk. Hmm. I think in the UK they call it the Mohican for whatever reason. Have they not seen Last of the Mohicans? Have you seen his hair? It's nothing like it. It's Mohawk hair. Yeah. Gosh, that annoys me. When they go like, "Oh, Mohican," you're like, pick up a history book.
They're rebelling against it, Lyle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, you have a good point, Lyle. Like, I don't think that a t-shirt and jeans would actually be very shocking, even if it is against the trend.
Yeah. So, like, when you look at Shadowrun and you say, hey, they all kind of look the same, calling it all look shocking. So, therefore, not looking shocking would be shocking. But you're like, nah, that's kind of.
Yeah, yeah,
I think that's a punk in a sense. But there are people in the punk movement who want to dress down, and they try to dress very functionally. And some of the punk fashions came because people came from an industrial background. So like the short hair for the skinheads, it's because that was a very low maintenance hair. It was also safe in a pure working in a factory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was also a reaction to people like the Mods
and the
Teddy Boys.
The Mohicans.
Yeah. Yeah. The Mohicans. Jeez.
Yeah.
The most amusing part of that is how bothered you are by it.
Oh, God.
For me.
Well, I had an English roommate, and I'm just like, oh, okay, but it's actually... And we actually watched Last of the Mohicans together.
I am going to sit you down and make you watch this movie.
And I was just like, notice his hair. Notice the Iroquois. Notice their hair. Iroquois Mohawks. But he would never change. He wouldn't change tomorrow.
He was rebelling against you, man.
Yeah. I'm the establishment.
Apparently so.
The established history. So just to recap of the questions so far, are the punks against the establishment and for individual freedom? Has society failed groups of people? Is their appearance or behavior designed to shock or provoke? And next, is there a strong element of do-it-yourself or anti-consumerism?
All right, and that dovetails into fashion because, as you said, kind of the short hair is very utilitarian, and a lot of people kind of, associate safety pins with punks, and part of that is just because they were recycling closings.
Oh, I think, Billy Bragg had a good quote. He said, without the Clash, punk would have just been a sneer, safety pins, and bondage pants.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously we're talking about punks being very anti-establishment, so part of that is the do-it-yourself ideal, because they don't want to buy into the corporate clothing lines, and they don't want to support those kinds of companies. So they would often go with ripped or torn, used clothing. They go through like secondhand shops or Salvation Army clothes to get used and worn clothing, and they would wear it with pride, again, to identify against the culture.
Yeah, but I think that kind of goes with anything and everything. Like, even you talk about, like, housing, where I guess you might get a lot of squatters because they're not going to buy a house. They're just kind of going to set up some place to live and then maintain it themselves rather than, hire a plumber or pay for anything to be done. So it's kind of like, if you can't do it yourself, if you can't fix this or maintain this yourself or make this yourself or get people together to help you do that, then are you really punk? I don't know. I would tend to say no.
Well, I think there's a slight line of difference between not having the money to hire someone to do it and, specifically choosing to do it yourself.
Right.
Well, in the case of squatters.
Like, even if you do have the money, if you then hire someone rather than do it yourself, that would kind of be a pride thing. Or just you're no longer punk because you are not doing it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this, you're right, it extends into all kinds of different areas. A lot of the punk music scene, they would try and release their own albums with their own record companies without signing on to the larger ones. They would put out their own magazines, calling them zines,
right,
and hand print them, hand write them, everything like that.
Right.
And this translates well into the cyberpunk thing, too, where the whole world is so technical with cybernetic limbs and kind of your home deck to get onto the internet. And all of these things you have to build yourself, because if you buy a corporate-controlled one, then they can take control of your arms or look into your brain. So it's a good rationale behind it.
Right. Or even if there's not like a bug in whatever corporate thing you buy, the fact that you can't maintain that or you didn't build that yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Is a big message.
Yeah, you're supporting the corpse, man.
Yeah, punk, that doesn't necessarily mean you have a lot of skills. I mean, putting paste safety pins through a shirt doesn't mean you can make a shirt.
Right.
Yeah, or a cybernetic arm.
Yeah. No, yeah, definitely like the squatting and that. Yeah, with Cyberpunk then, I guess you kind of make it your own, and they would do that, where they would have more jury-rigged cybernetics, but maybe right. they get the other thing. I think a lot of the anti-consumerism maybe had to do with the fact that they just didn't have any money.
Mm.
Like a lot of them were on, in the UK, would say on the dole or on welfare back in North America.
Right.
On assistance. Might be the nicer way to say it.
Sucking on the government. Yeah, anyway.
But here's something about Shadowrun and Cyberpunk, which maybe is a little bit of a disconnect from punk, is that we kind of identify them through their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas punk, we don't identify right. them through their right. jobs unless they're a punk musician. Even somebody who was who made punk fashions, you wouldn't really, you would figure that the other fashion designer makes punk clothes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But punk, yeah, like somebody works in a factory, but then as a punk on their free time, we don't think, oh, he's a factory worker.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That they're a punk. So they're not a runner. They're a punk.
Right. Yeah. That's a really good point. Do you think that is because it is a game and because we mechanically need to differentiate characters rather than just them just all kind of being the same thing? I mean, it's kind of, D&D and the introduction of classes and, you know, role-playing games kind of still hold on to those classes to keep characters distinct and from players stepping on each other's toes in terms of what their characters can do. But maybe like a point buy system, you could do more of an actual punk because it doesn't really matter if you're, or there's different ways to mechanically differentiate your character, because let's be honest, a group of people isn't going to want to play identical characters.
Maybe. The cyberpunk classes, for what it's worth, they were very punk, though. I mean, one of them was a musician. The news reporter one was, pointing out the problems and the power and getting into the air. Even the cop was part of you're one of the good officers, wherever the rest of the department is corrupt. Though I think actually one of the options was corporate goon, but we'll leave that one to the side.
No, I think my point is, I mean, you need maybe classes or... Not necessarily, but I mean, you could point by, but you're going to have some sort of skill set.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I guess my point is, just because you're a runner or you're a hacker doesn't mean you're a punk.
Oh, no, I absolutely got that.
There's not necessarily no punk jobs. So if you're going to play Cyberpunk or Shadowrun or something...
It's not automatically punk.
Yeah, I mean, if a street samurai is just a bodyguard... Then you're a bodyguard. You're not a punk bodyguard.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're a street samurai, whatever that is. Right. What is it you're adding to that character that makes you punk? You're a hacker. There's a lot of hackers that sit there and that love J-pop or they love,
whatever.
Yeah, they might like country music or something like that. But they're really good hackers, and they shop at Abercrombie and Finch or The Gap, because that's what they like, or they don't really care.
Hmm.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. Shadowrun is not based around the punk movement at all, even though it defines itself as cyberpunk, because it's about going on runs and doing jobs and getting money for it. It's not necessarily about fighting the establishment, though of course you could make a game that way. Even back in the day when I played cyberpunk, we didn't play it punk. We played like Black Ops mercenaries, going on jobs and things like that, not fighting against the power.
Right. So, and again, I think that's kind of what pushes it into... kind of the non-punk area. It's, if you're playing a punk game, I don't think it's enough to have your characters just kind of keep their heads down and go about doing whatever they're doing. You kind of have to be actively fighting the establishment.
You don't just do punk, you be punk.
No, that's a good point. I mean, punk is not really, in a sense, it's not a thing. It's a reaction to something. So, I mean, it's got to clash with something.
Right.
So,
you intentionally have to go out and rattle people's cages.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's like somebody saying that, talking about saving the queen and it's a fascist regime in their bedroom, or just amongst their friends. That's not really punk. That's but if you make an album saying that, or talking about being an antichrist and an anarchist, then that's punk.
As long as you're not following somebody, because then you're just a poser.
Right. Oh, there's another good quote. And not by
some... Is that the trash can one?
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. The Billy Armstrong. Somebody asked him, so what is punk? He kicked over a trash can, and he said, that's punk. So the guy kicked over a trash can himself and said, is that punk? He said, no, that's trendy.
Yeah, and that's from, like, Green Day guy. And I, are they punk? but that's a good quote. That's a good quote. Yeah, it was a list of quotes about punk. Mm-hmm. And not everybody was punk. Like, Billy Bragg was on there, and he's not punk. But then it's like Blink-182, and I'm like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, even if they aren't punk, they can still talk about it.
Oh, like us.
Yeah.
Hey.
Sounds good. And the next question is, and it gets into the, like, whether or not you're punk or trendy, is are your punks obsessed with authenticity?
Because if you're not authentic, you're just a poser.
Just kicking over trash cans.
After someone else has done it.
Yes.
That's the important part. Yeah.
If they care about anything, it's they care about that they're punk and what is punk. That's an important thing. And even like not caring, I mean, they not care in a very caring way. I don't know. It's a very, very practice indifference, I guess you could say.
Right.
Or very affected indifference.
In your face laziness.
Yeah. Something like that. But yeah, it's... They might not want to call themselves punk, but they would certainly take issue if somebody else described themselves as punk and they didn't think that they were.
Right.
So.
Right. No, I think the thing I read said that a poser is someone who habitually dresses or pretends to be something they are not and does not kind of embrace the ideology of whatever it is they're mimicking. So it could be someone, in this case, who has the mohawk, you know, the leather jacket, the Doc Martens, the ripped jeans, but then who kind of doesn't...
They bought them at a department
store. Yeah, exactly. You bought them at a department store. You just kind of sit quietly on the bus without...
You vote for the majority party.
Yeah, yeah. You don't get up in people's face about trying to change the system. You just kind of go about your business while wearing that. So you aren't embracing what it actually means to be punk. You're just assuming the affectations of that group.
All I'm saying is John Mayer can really rock sometimes. He's a good guitarist.
That's Blink 182, man. They are punk. You know, to me, this not being within the culture, it smelled a lot like that was the method of their pecking order. That was how you found the alpha punk.
What, kicking over trash cans and seeing who got up in your face?
No, just kind of... debating over who is the most authentic, who lives and breathes the most punk.
Yeah, so the person that squats would be, you know, has something up on the person that actually rents an apartment.
Hey, exactly. Hey, yeah. You know what? How is that any different from hipsters now? I liked that before anybody else did.
Hey. Yeah, I don't disagree at all.
It's like, oh, nobody wants to play Steam Hipster.
My arm dispenses coffee.
Oh, yeah? Well, my arm dispensed coffee back before everybody was drinking coffee.
Really? I got rid of that coffee arm attachment ages ago.
Phonograph, I have a string quartet following me.
But we got our show notes.
Yeah. That was a good one.
I think this is hard to play. But I think it can, I mean, it can actually be a lot of fun in that. I mean, we've talked about, oh, you know, cyberpunk's not really punk, and steampunk's not really punk, and Shadowrun's not really punk. But if you in make your characters punk in those games, they can look down at the runners and just like, oh, yeah, you guys are hardcore.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? Then, like, when that punk looking down on all the runners gets hit with the rocket from the, you know, the corporate goon because has the mohawk and that flashy vest, well, then that's going to be really short lived character.
All right, don't put so many points in authenticity then. So we've got the five questions, the five core questions. This last one's a bonus question because we're really struggling now to think you could work this into a game. But do the punks identify themselves through music, which you have to admit is a pretty big deal in the punk subculture?
Right.
Yeah, before I knew anything about the punk subculture, I knew about punk music as a genre.
Yep, same here. Yeah, that could be really hard, because how do you work music into a game other than to play it during the session, or play it at certain points
in
the session?
Or a player plays a musician or a rock star or something like that.
Right, right. But I think you kind of did a little bit of that, Lyle, with the the vampire game where you decided the Gangrels were a bit more, I don't know, kind of, was it metal? If they were going to have kind of like a soundtrack or a theme?
Yeah, like the with that one session using like, I actually used the Stooges.
Hmm.
So it was actually more punk. You have a real ear for punk music.
Yeah, apparently I do. I've been drowned out by the metal I listen to.
You think that's bad? When you said I played the Stooges, I was thinking background music like whoop whoop whoop.
Oh, geez. Sorry, no, it was Iggy Pop and the Stooges, like Search and Destroy, and I Want to Be Your Dog. So I forget what game we were playing when we had to listen to Wayne's black metal.
No, it was Viking metal.
Or Viking metal.
Oh please, I never played that.
Was no, I actually was doing a board game. It's like my God.
Yep.
You really made that board game Viking metal.
I think you lasted, 5 minutes before, can we turn this off?
Yeah.
I had to sit next to the stereo, thank you.
What's wrong? That's the best place to sit.
But, I mean, yeah, if there's ever a game where you want to incorporate music and make it a part and people are going to listen to it and have it in the background, then it's a game where you're trying to incorporate punk elements.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even that they listen to punk music, but I think they gather and listen to the music as well, so... Mm-hmm. Gather around the music, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's how to use it in the game. It's like, you know, there are scenes where the action are going to take place, or there's places where the characters are going to go. And because music is such a large part of the punk subculture, it's going to be at places that are playing music. It's going to be at, you know, punk concert. It's going to be at, you know, kind of back, maybe not back alley, but, you know, kind of industrial sites turned into, you know, concerts. It's there is going to be music around these gatherings, and it might only be background in terms of what gets described for the scene, but it would be an important piece of background.
It could also be the way that these characters connect. So they connect through the music. Of course, they're all punks, but you could have the corporate shill, but this is my job. This is how I feed myself, but I hate it. I rebel against it, you know, when I'm not working. And then they gather, and then they connect through the music. And it doesn't have to be like a Shadowrun or Cyberpunk kind of game. It could be why these vampires identify with each other. It could be, if you're doing like a fantasy punk, why these groups of people, like wizard, fighter, cleric, why they are identifying themselves, or why they're coming together.
Punk.
What's that? They
listen to Bardic Punk.
Bardic Punk. Yeah.
Well, no, you saying that, Lyle. I mean, think about how many imaginary rules of society the typical D&D party breaks intentionally.
Murder hobos.
Yeah, murder hobos. Who cares what the town guard says? We're going to do this. Or, who cares for the due process? We're going to torture that guy. You know, burn their house down. Just, you know, kill everything with fire. In that light, the average kind of fantasy party seems pretty punkish to me.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it might be a fine line, though, between fighting against the authority and complete disregard.
Well,
for what the authority says, because you're level 30, and what can the king do?
Right, that's a very good point. You know,
and you're a sociopath. You know,
exactly. No. You know what? Yeah, that clarified it. They seem punk, but they are not trying to change society. They're just incredibly selfish and don't care about it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're talking about anti-consumerism. I mean, is anybody like? They're consumed. I mean, they're the they're like the Wall Street of the fantasy world. It's just like they're all greed, and it's just like, I don't care. It makes money, right? Yeah,
right.
Let's do it.
Let's go kill all those humanoids and steal all their stuff and then sell it to get rich.
Yeah, if I could sell them penny stocks and make a commission, I'd do that too, but this is just easier. Let's just do this.
But they haven't invented markets yet. I never realized just how it D&D is.
Well, I don't think it's only D&D. It's most fantasy stuff, but...
Yeah, it's true. You
know? Imagine like a group of punk superheroes. Like, they're not heroes or villains. They're just... Like, no one knows what they would do.
I imagine them all having mohawks and just like smoking cigarettes out on the street, kind of not really doing anything and just getting in old ladies' faces and just saying.
But their healing factor prevents the lung cancer. So it's just
like... Well, you know, I mean, punk, a lot of the punk movement was being really activist towards personal freedoms. And if you're a superhero, you can be very activist.
Yep.
That's the question, you know. I mean, the punk movement in the real world, it never got powerful enough to affect the kind of grand change that a Superman interested in doing that kind of thing would be able to do. That's a really interesting question. It'd be fun to explore in a campaign.
Yeah, why do I wear my underwear outside my tights? Because they're... Why
<'Cause>
not?
Punk.
Yeah. shapeshifter. If you had shapeshifter powers, imagine what you'd look like.
Hmm. I don't kick over trash cans. I kick over buildings.
Oh, yeah. We talk about the shocking and provoking, the Tsimisian vampire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, they get into that. So.
That'd be pretty creepy.
Well, there's certainly definitely elements there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually kind of want to do that campaign now.
Mm. We almost had those Tsimisis come in. Well, we actually did, but...
Mm. They certainly were not punk.
Well, that they were in disguise.
Right.
They were disguised as squares.
Yeah, actually, one thing I forgot to talk about in the authenticity thing was the idea of selling out, which was kind of the big point when you could break your authenticity in return for profit and popularity.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you can do it as like, when we're, I mean, I don't think we've trashed Cyberpunk or Shadowrun because they're both great games. But yeah, they could be like, we were punk and now we're selling out, and then that could be part of the character arc. Do you want to go punk again? Like somebody from their past can visit them and kind of remind them of who they were.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. It could be hard because you'd have to get the players to self-motivate on it, but you know, you could make that as one of the big moral questions in it. You know, do you remain true to your ideals here, or as a chance, do you go for the power? Do you go for the money?
You know, it could be really interesting is like if you have, using the werewolf example, I really like going back to this, but you know, they're a tribe, so they're very connected to each other, but they're actually like separate from the regular society. Mm-hmm. So somebody who goes and joins the regular society and leaves the tribe, are they selling out or is staying with the tribe, like not punk, because, you know, I want to do what I want. You're the establishment. Who's the establishment? Mainstream society or that little supernatural society that they're a part of?
Right.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, I think like vampire plays with this a bit. With, you know, some of the vampire groups are, you know, very punk.
Mm.
And they do have the powers, like when we're talking about the superheroes, they do have the ability to be a bit freer than the average person, and they take advantage of that.
Yeah.
But what about the ones that divorce themselves from vampire society? I know in previous incarnations talked about them being anarchs.
Right.
And really defining who they were. But they're like, well, no, I don't just want to be a separate group of vampires. Mm-hmm. I want to go and join regular society.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the at least in Vampire the Requiem, the punk covenant, that was the Carthians, wasn't it? Where they're just kind of like, okay, we're going to do all this, you know, experimental kind of forms of government, and we're fighting against the status quo, and, you know, things in vampire society are broken, and so we're just going to kill it with fire and then rebuild it from the ashes.
In a sense, yeah, one way to describe them as punk, but yeah, they could also be very libertarian or Randian. Or objective, yeah.
Well, they, as you had with yours.
Yeah, again, like punk weren't any kind of one, you know, solidified group of political ideals. It was just that we're fighting against the current system to set up something else that we think is going to work better.
Do they really want to set up something better? Or they just want to fight against the system?
Yeah,
I don't know. It's a genuine question.
Well, later on, there was the really good kind of when we're in power section, I think, which is in the updated Blood and Smoke. And then I think there was mention of them kind of not knowing what to do because without something to fight or without another authority to fight, they kind of broke down. They didn't do well as the establishment or as the authority. They did best when they were fighting against it. And if they actually got into power, well, then things kind of didn't work that well.
Ah, so the Minshuto.
Yeah. So sounds punk and libertarian.
Okay.
Okay, that ends our episode on punk and what it is to be punk and whether or not your game is punk. And if you want to know if you are authentic and you are punk, ask yourself these questions. All right, sorry. If your game is punk and your game is authentic,
you don't care if you're punk. Ask yourself these questions, too, and if you say yes to the majority of them, you're probably punk as well.
I wonder how many punks actually play role-playing games.
They do, it ain't D&D.
I don't know. I could imagine quite a few. I mean, there was a point when D&D was very counterculture. So.
And it's not now.
No.
So the questions that you should ask yourself are the quote-unquote punks against the establishment and for individual freedom? Number two, has society failed groups of people? Number three, are the punks' behavior and appearance designed to shock or provoke? Number four, is there a strong element of DIY or anti-consumerism among the punks? Number five, are the quote-unquote punks obsessed with authenticity? And number six, the bonus question, do the quote-unquote punks identify themselves through music?
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
See you later, punk.
Bye. It's like Clint Eastwood. Is Clint Eastwood punk?
No.
No.
I was, yeah. It was either Clint Eastwood or Bane.
See you later, punk.
Well, I was waiting for Bane, and I'm like, oh, geez.
Yeah, I'm just, someone's going to do Bane.
Yeah, I paused, and I was like, wow, I can't do Bane twice.
Do I do it?
No, but you kind of just sound like Dirty Harry, so sort of like not punk. Do you feel lucky, punk? Yeah, that should have been one of our questions. Do you say punk? Right.
Use the word. Bonus question number 7. Do you feel lucky, punk? Do it. Come on, splice it in.
We already said it, dude.
That'll be an outtake, yeah.
Cool. All
right. You'd be like, now you say it. And then I say it, then you're going to go, trendy.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.